Join me tonight in John chapter 20. We began in Genesis this morning. Tonight we're going to begin in John 20. I want to grab an episode from the life of Jesus. And we'll read it together and then we'll work it a little bit for our study tonight. So I'm in John 20. And I'm going down to verse 19 and we'll read to the end of the chapter. Will you join me there? John 20, verse 19 says, "So when it was evening on that day, the first day of the week, and when the doors were shut where the disciples were for fear of the Jews, Jesus came and stood in their midst and said to them, 'Peace be with you.' When he had said this, he showed them both his hands and his side. The disciples then rejoiced when they saw the Lord. So Jesus said to them again, 'Peace be with you. As the Father has sent me, I also send you.' And when he said this, he breathed on them and said, 'Receive the Holy Spirit. If you forgive the sins of any, their sins have been forgiven them. If you retain the sins of any, they have been retained.' But Thomas, one of the 12 called Didymus, was not with them when Jesus came. So the other disciples were saying to him, 'We have seen the Lord.' But he said to them, 'Unless I see in his hands the imprint of the nails and put my finger into the place of the nails and place my hand into his side, I will not believe.' After 8 days, his disciples were again inside and Thomas with them. Jesus came, the doors having been shut, and stood in their midst, and he said, 'Peace be with you.' Then he said to Thomas, 'Reach here with your finger and see my hands. And reach here with your hand and put it into my side. And do not be unbelieving, but believing.' Thomas answered and said to him, 'My Lord and my God.' Jesus said to him, 'Because you have seen me, you believe. Blessed are they who do not see and yet believe. Therefore, many other signs Jesus also performed in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book, but these have been written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you might have life in his name." I don't know of any struggle that poses a greater threat to our spiritual stability than to wrestle with doubts about the things that we believe and to not be sure what we ought to do about them, to not know how to process them. And yet, in spite of the danger that that poses, we find ourselves in a culture today, increasingly surrounded by a crowd who does not believe even the very basic things that you and I believe. There is a God. The Bible is the Word of God. And so, as you and I make this journey through life, increasingly we are stumbling across people with a profoundly different view of the world than the one that you and I have. And as a consequence of that, I think increasingly we find ourselves wrestling when we have conversations and interactions and we talk about spiritual things, wrestling with things that threaten to stir within us doubts about the things that we believe. Maybe it will be a conversation with a gay coworker, where they can confide that they have had same-sex attractions ever since they can remember, and they're convinced, "I was born that way." Or maybe it'll be sitting at a university somewhere in a biology classroom as the professor with a couple of PhDs builds the mountain of evidence that demonstrates how unreasonable it is to believe anything but Darwin's theory of evolution. Or maybe it'll be the really top-notch, well-produced YouTube video that scoffs at anyone who could believe in a God who in his own book endorses slavery. What do I do with that? And so I think it's all the more important in the times in which we're living to know how to process our doubts well. And so tonight, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about that. I think it is one of our most important struggles, and we need to struggle well. You will hear me lean a lot toward young people tonight. It isn't that the rest of us don't have doubts. We do. I just especially worry about the kids, okay? Because their world is going to be profoundly different than our own, and I think they are the most at risk among us. So I'm not excluding everybody else. If you hear me concentrate on them, I just worry more about them, if that makes any sense. So let's talk a little bit about how to process doubts in a healthy way. And I want to begin, let me put a word on the slide. I want to begin by thinking about our thinking. In other words, I want you to think with me about how we think about our doubts. Because I think that's where the trouble begins, within our minds and how we think about the things that we have doubts about. And so I want to say a couple of things about our thinking. The first thing I want to say to you is that everybody has doubts, right? If you're an exception, would you raise your hand? Okay, I'm glad we got that covered. Everybody wrestles with doubts. I'm not saying we wrestle with the same doubts or we wrestle through the same depth, but all of us are going to pass through those seasons. For some of us, it happened in college. Did that happen for any of y'all? I remember going away for the first time, being a long way from home, and beginning to think about these things I'd always been taught, and having that struggle. Some of you will remember this. Having that struggle, do I just believe this because I was raised up believing this stuff? Or do I believe this because it's true? And those are two very different things, right? And then sometimes you find yourself in a college setting where you're confronted with very new and different ideas that are in conflict with what you've always been taught to believe, and they're coming from very educated people. And what can that do? Well, sometimes it makes you doubt and wonder. And if not then, maybe a little later in life, maybe when you're sitting at lunch, having that conversation with a coworker who hits you with a passage you've never even seen before. Ever had that happen? Or an argument against something that you believe you've never even considered before. And you don't really know what to say. And you walk away from that conversation, and what's working in the back of your mind is, what else could I be wrong about? Or what other passages have I not seen? And you begin to have some doubts, right? Maybe to be later in life. When your mom, who's a good, godly woman, gets a terrible disease and lingers and suffers with it and dies. And you begin to wonder, she served God her whole life. Why would he allow her to suffer that way? And you doubt. I think we all pass through our seasons at some point. And should we really be surprised? I mean, we just read from John 20 about Thomas and his struggles with doubts. Have you ever stopped to ponder all the advantages Thomas has coming into this situation? He had been with Jesus for years. He had heard Jesus make the claims, I am the Son of God. He had witnessed the miracles that validated the claims. He had heard Jesus announce that he would die and rise again. And he had an advantage over the other apostles. Reliable eyewitness testimony. The other apostles had come to him and said, we've seen the Lord, and yet still he doubts. How could he? And I don't even think that's the best example of apostolic doubt. I think the best example is in Matthew 14. Do you remember this story? When the disciples have set across the Sea of Galilee on the boat, and Jesus comes to them at night walking on the water. You remember that story? And he draws close, and what does Peter say? Me too. If you're really Jesus, let me come to you on the water. And Jesus says, come on. I would just suggest that if there was going to be a moment in that encounter to doubt, it's the first step out of the boat, right? That would be the hurdle to get over. Folks, Peter blows right past that. He gets out of the boat. He starts going to Jesus, and then he looks around. Maybe an example of his impulsiveness, right? And he sees the wind and the waves, and he fears, and he sinks. He doubts then? So my point about that is, if even Thomas and Peter doubted, should we be surprised when we do? In fact, that leads me to the second thing that I want to emphasize tonight as we think about how we think about our doubts. I think we need to recognize, folks, it doesn't make you a bad person if you have doubts. Do you know why I'm saying that? Because I want you guys to hear me say that. You're not bad if you have doubts. You know why I looked over there? I've had young people tell me that. I struggled with doubts the whole time I was growing up. But I mean, everyone else around me seemed to believe it. And my mom and dad believed it. And I thought I was the only one. And I just felt like I was a bad person because I was having doubts. I've had kids say to me, I thought something was wrong with me. So we need our kids to know that lots of good, sincere, truth-seeking people struggle. I remember several years ago, one of our girls was about to marry this boy, and he was struggling with doubts. And so he agreed to come and meet with me. We sat down in the office, and he shared his story with me. He had grown up a believer. He believed in God. He believed in the Bible. And he said, here's the problem. I went off to college and heard some things I hadn't heard before. I listened to the professor build the mountain of evidence for the theory of evolution, and I realized that's in conflict with what I've been taught from the Bible. And he said, I began to doubt. He said, now listen, I don't want to be an unbeliever. I want the Bible to be true. I'm not looking for a path out here to go live a life of immorality or something. I want the Bible to be true. He just said, I'm not willing to check my brain at the door of the church building. And God doesn't want you to check your brain at the door of the church building. I would say that this process we go through when we have doubts of evaluating what we believe and re-examining the evidence, I think ultimately in the end produces a stronger faith, even if it means for a season I'm uncertain and struggling. So I think that we need especially to say to our kids and to anyone else who needs to hear this, doubt is a normal part of the journey. And you're not bad if you're experiencing those. Our kids need to grow up believing that. And I need y'all to help me with that. Because now I've said it 3 or 4 times standing up here tonight, and it isn't enough. One of the things that I think our church families need to communicate with to our young people is this is a safe place to talk about your doubts, to put it on the table. An interesting moment, oddly enough, last week in my Bible class, we've been studying worship, and we were dealing with the issue of instrumental music. And I told the kids at the beginning of the class, this is a safe place. Don't just give me Bible class answers. Tell me what you really think about this. So as we're going through this discussion of instrumental music, we made this argument against the use. And one of the guys from across the room, he kind of went like this. It's kind of like, can I really raise my hand? And I said, okay, well, what do you want? He said, okay, I'm going to say this. I'm not really sure I'm buying that argument. Is it okay to say that? You see that? And I said, it's absolutely okay to say that. What's your problem? Put it on the table. Let's talk about it. If it's a bad argument, let's unmake it. If you misunderstand, let's clear it up. But you see the problem? We need to make the church family the safe place to talk about doubts. You with me on that? You worried about kids having doubts? Now, what do you want them to talk about? I've even wondered about Thomas. We put a label on him. We call him the doubter, right? And you've already heard me say, he had ample reason to believe. But folks, even if you say Jesus admonishes him here, it's a gentle admonishment. What Jesus really wants to do is help Thomas believe. And if I am struggling with doubt, that's what he wants for me too. He wants to help me believe. So let's push this forward. Let's talk about something else. Once I'm thinking straight about my doubts, everyone has them. I'm not a bad person. The second thing we need to tackle is how we're going to process them. So what do I do with them? I think already we've dealt a little bit with what not to do, right? You can't avoid them. You can't ignore your doubts. It's sort of like ignoring the signs that your house has termites. And that may be okay today, but judgment day is coming out there, right? They're going to eat up the house from the inside. The wind's going to come and it's going to blow and knock your house down. That'll happen to you spiritually too. You can't ignore them. Your doubts aren't going away. There's a flip side to that problem. Nor can we give up on faith too quickly. And I see young people do that too. They have someone challenge something they believe or make an argument that they never heard before and they don't know how to answer. And then they make this leap that if I don't know the answer, there must not be an answer. And they give up that quickly on their faith. So we need to be clear about something. Just because I don't know the answer, that doesn't mean there's not an answer. And just because my mom and dad don't know what the answer is, that doesn't mean there's not an answer. And just because my preacher doesn't give me a very good answer, present company accepted, Philip, okay? And you too, bud, I'm not leaving you out. Doesn't mean there isn't a good answer. My coworker likes, we work with college kids all the time, and my coworker likes to tell them, listen, nobody's got anything new. The critics are using arguments to get faith that have been recycled generation after generation after generation for thousands of years. Okay? Just because you don't know doesn't mean there isn't an answer. So what should I do with my doubts? Well, you go back to our text. We've been away from that a while. Let's go back to John 20. And I want you to notice what Jesus tells Thomas to do. Are you there? Look at verse 27. And he said to Thomas, reach here with your finger and see my hands, and reach here with your hand and put it into my side. What is he urging him to do? I think he's urging Thomas to do an investigation. Look at the evidence. What do you see? I am worried that there are some disciples who are fearful about doing that, about really looking at what evidence there is for the things that we believe. For example, this question of how the Bible has been transmitted down through time, and can we be sure that what was originally written is what we're reading in our Bible today? I think there's some people afraid to dig down into that because they fear we might find out that we can't really trust our Bible. And so they just kind of bury their head in the sand and don't go there. Listen, brothers and sisters, let me be clear about something. And I want y'all to hear me on this, okay? Let me be clear. We are not guardians of the traditions. That is not who we are. We are on a quest to know what is true. And part of that quest means being willing to put it all on the table. Jesus was willing to do that. Back up to John 10 for a minute. Will you look there? I love this story. From John 10, look down at verse number 37. This is John 10, verse 37. Notice what Jesus says to his critics. If I do not do the works of my Father, do not believe me. Jesus had made amazing claims, but he subjects himself here to the test of evidence. If I don't back up those claims with evidence, you have no obligation to believe it. I can't just say it. It's got to be evidence that it's so. And then in verse 38 he says, but if I do them, that is if I do the works of the Father, I think he means miracles there. If I do them, though you do not believe me, believe the works so that you may know and understand that the Father is in me and I am in the Father. I think Jesus realizes that some people were just hung up with him personally. He was not the Messiah they were looking for. And so what he says for a moment is, forget about me. Look at what I am doing. If I can raise people from the dead, you probably need to take a look at what I'm saying. See the point? Brothers and sisters, the only thing that has to fear careful examination is the things that are wrong. Truth, when carefully evaluated and analyzed, only looks more true. You with me on that? So we need to encourage our young people. Don't just blindly accept what you've always been taught. Look at the evidence. Be willing to ask tough questions. I am not fearful at all urging our kids to do that. I know how this is going to come out. Start looking at the evidence for things we believe, brothers and sisters, and it just becomes clear that what we believe is true. Now, let me add one other little piece to that. That will hinge on making sure we do a fair investigation. Okay? So let me illustrate that if I can. You may go off to a university somewhere, and the professor gives you a nice big $125 textbook that gives you the mountain of evidence for Darwin's theory of evolution. What do you want your kid to do with that textbook? Read it. I wanted my kids to carefully study Darwin's theory of evolution. Look carefully at their evidence too. I think the more you study the theory, you're going to start to see some problems with it. I just think we need to be sure that that's not the only book our kids read. They can read that one. Wouldn't be a bad idea to read Michael Behe's book, Darwin's Black Box, or Stephen J. Meyer's book, Signature in the Cell. Some good books to read too, but they come at the evidence from an entirely different perspective. That's part of the problem, I think, in our culture today. Unbelievers are doing their level best. Unbelievers are doing their level best to be sure that kids don't grow up with both sides of the story. Isn't that curious? If the argument for the Genesis creation is so weak, if the evidence is so lacking, you would think evolutionists would want that taught in public schools right alongside Darwinian evolution so that it would be obvious which one is true. It kind of makes me wonder what they're trying to hide. Why they don't want kids to grow up with a whole story. You be sure your investigation is fair. And you get the whole story. I think some kids just give up on faith too quickly because of bad process. They get hit with something they can't answer. They assume there's not an answer, and they give up on faith. That's bad process. And because of what it is that we're dealing with, we can't give it that kind of a half-hearted effort. One more thing. Actually, two more words, but the last one I'm just going to throw in at the end anyway. Once we've gone through the process of investigating, we have to come to a decision. If you go back to our text, that's exactly what Jesus urges Thomas to do in John chapter 20. Look at verse 27. Reach here with your finger and see my hands, and reach here with your hand and put it into my side. Notice, and do not be unbelieving, but believing. After weighing the evidence, Jesus says to Thomas, you're going to have to come to some decision about the evidence you've examined. You're going to have to make a call. Do you believe it or not? It's interesting that he calls Thomas to a decision, in spite of the fact that Thomas doesn't have all the answers about Jesus yet. Have you ever thought about that? In fact, as one example, Thomas, at this point, doesn't have any idea what this death and resurrection business was all about. And where is all of that going? They're going to learn a whole lot about Jesus as the gospel begins to be revealed to them, but that's still in the future. But I can tell you what Thomas knows at this moment, in this episode that we read. He knew that Jesus claimed to be God. And he watched him die on the cross. And now he's alive. So there's no way he can be wrong about his claim. You see that? And so what does Thomas say in verse 28? My Lord and my God. He came to a decision based on the evidence he had, and he believed. I've decided in my little circle of experience that basically there are only two kinds of people in the world. There are people that are looking for questions and people who are looking for answers, and everyone's going to find what they're looking for. It's just what kind of person I choose to be. Because I'm going to tell you, brothers and sisters, we're not ever going to have all the answers to all the questions. You know what my problem is? I don't even know what all the questions are yet. And my suspicion is, when I finish with the current list, there will be more after that. The point I'm trying to make is that I don't think that keeps me from making a decision now, based on the evidence I have about what I believe. If I could illustrate that. I don't have all the answers to every question that could be raised about the creation-evolution debate in our culture. I'm not even sure I know what all of those questions are. But I can tell you what I do know. I have spent some time marveling at creation. I am most impressed, I am not a scientist, and I don't pretend to be one on Sundays, but I've read what some scientists have said about DNA, the coding in the cells that makes them do what they do and makes us uniquely who we are. That is pretty amazing stuff. So I've read a little bit about that. And I will tell you, that for me, DNA just does not work with Darwin's theory of evolution, that something came from nothing and given enough time, nature on its own could code DNA and first life. Listen, even evolutionists struggle with believing that, so much so that one of the current theories is aliens must have come and put life here, right? There are actually very intelligent scientists that are basing that view. What's leading them to that? Folks, they can't figure out how to do DNA without some kind of intelligence acting on it. The more I learn about that, the more I'm convinced that there must have been a fantastic intelligence behind all of that. Which gets me to God. It's the reason I believe in Him. I think His evidence is there. And when the questions come along, and they do, I just do what Jesus told Thomas to do. I try to conduct a fair examination. I try to look honestly at the evidence and figure out what is true. But today, that's what I believe, based on the evidence that I have in front of me. I can make a decision about what I believe based on the evidence that I have. And I would remind you, if you're still in John 20, if you'll look at verses 30 and 31, Jesus says that the evidence we've been provided is sufficient to produce belief. The last word I'm going to throw up here, and I'll wrap up with this one, is the word implications, only to emphasize what is at stake in what we decide. This is a big deal. Jesus said that it is through belief in Him that we have life. Real life now, eternal life after this life. That's what's hanging in the balance here. It's too important to use bad process in dealing with our doubts. Are y'all with me on that? Nod your heads up and down. Yeah, right? Good. Thank you. Too important to give a half-hearted effort. This is the stuff of life. And so because of the implications, we need to process those seasons of doubt well. Life is at stake. I wonder, do you have it? The life that Jesus is promising here, do you have it? Because tonight the Lord extends His invitation to you to receive it. If you will come to Him and respond to His call to believe in His Son, with the abundant evidence we've been given to prove that Jesus is the Son of God, to embrace His offer of salvation, to be cleansed in baptism, have a relationship maybe for the first time with your Father. You need to do that tonight. Act on what you know is true. Decide that you want to make things right with God tonight. There's an empty pew right here. And if you'll come sit down here, we'll do what we can to help you with that. Make your way to the front while we stand, while we sing.